Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Life Coach David Bartke here.
It is Thursday, October the 5th, 2017. We are well on the way into autumn, and the leaves are starting to turn. And I don't know about you, David. This is one of my favorite times of year, particularly where I live here in New England, just because the color of the leaves is spectacular.
Yes, it is. It is a wonderful time of year, and I love going for drives on certain highways that go through all the wonderful, beautiful trees and all the different colors. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. One of our favorite things is to drive on I-90 going through Massachusetts. Right at peak color. I mean, it's like a palette of color. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. Like, when you see pictures of it, you think, oh, how nice. But when you see it in person, it's really like, wow.
Isn't that something? Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to translate it to photography.
Yeah.
And I don't know
some
why.
Some things you can. You can just look at it and be like, oh, how nice. But some things, when you actually are there and seeing it for yourself, it's just like, makes so much of a difference.
Yeah. I've never really figured out why, because the camera actually sees more than we do. But I don't know. Maybe it's just the ability the ability of the camera to render the entire color space or something. I'm not sure what. But
yeah, you get a different feeling in person or something.
Yeah, he certainly did. Well, speaking of getting a feeling, that's basically what the law of attraction is about. And we are continuing our exploration of Abraham Hicks's Asking It Is Given, which, of course, talks, among other things, about feelings. But it also talks about, we're on chapter 7 now, by the way. Can you believe that? We're on chapter 7.
Wow. We're plowing through it.
Chapter 7's subtitle is, You Are Standing on the Leading Edge of Thought. So let's dive into it.
That sounds impressive.
It does. It sounds like, whoa, okay. So starting it off, it says, we like to refer to the place where you are standing as the leading edge of thought, for as you stand there in your physical body, in your physical environment, having your physical experience, you are the furthermost extension of that which we are. So again, this is the metaphysical side of the law of attraction and how non-physical and physical beings interact, which pushes the limits of belief for some people. If this part kind of gives you a hard time, that's okay. You can skip this chapter, but there are some good...
It's interesting to read it anyway.
But there are also some good stuff in here, so maybe you don't want to skip the total chapter as a whole. Just skip that one little piece of it.
Yeah.
So continuing on, all that has ever been before is culminating into that which you are now. And just as all of your experience from the time of your birth into your physical body until now has culminated into who you are now, all that has ever been experienced by all that is has culminated into all that is now being experienced in the physical life experience on Earth. That's where we start to get that dense language again.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a tongue twister.
I think we can make that simple by just saying all that you experience, we experience it too.
Right, and that's all culminated to where we all are right now.
It is an interesting and a somewhat daunting concept, perhaps. The idea that what you and I and all of our listeners do and think and so forth in some way impacts others physically and others in the non-physical realm.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's pretty daunting.
It is daunting, and it's one of the messages that comes through regularly in this book and indeed in all Abraham Hicks workshops and so forth. The idea that just by thinking about things that we are interested in, that we like, that we want, that we're attracting, that we desire, whatever it might be, just by thinking about them and focusing on them and then attracting them into their lives, we are impacting the overall growth of the universe. That theme plays out over and over again in those talks.
Yes, yes.
And I'm still not quite sure what to do with that information.
I just think, like, I kind of paraphrase it in my own mind as well. The more people that are keeping themselves at a raised vibration, the more it's helping the planet, because everything's vibrational. So in my mind, that's kind of what that means.
Okay.
Well, we're part of improving things because we deliberately do our best to keep ourselves at a raised vibration. So if more and more people do that, then it all kind of comes together and is helping more. You know, that's kind of how I look at that.
That's a reasonable way to look at it. I can't say I have a better explanation, so I'll go with that one.
Right.
Now, this section does conclude in an interesting way. It says, in other words, because of what so many have lived and are living, and because of the summoning power of so many of their desires, the well-being of your future experience is well in place. And in like manner, your current desires will in turn provide an energy stream for future generations to benefit from. Now, that I can at least tie into a little bit easier. It's easier for me to identify with that. Because we can certainly look back on history and see the development of humankind and of technology and understanding and education and so forth. And certainly what we know now and what we have now relies heavily on what happened with our ancestors and what they did and what their ancestors did and so on and so forth. You can see the progression through history. So that I can kind of buy into a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. I think what their physical actions determined how we are now.
Right. Their physical actions, their choices, their thoughts, all of that, it all kind of add up to a series of experiences and developments and so forth, many of which we benefit from now. So that part makes sense to me. Now, that's their lead-in for the section about how you as an individual, how each of us as an individual can apply it for not only ourselves, but for future generations. This subsection is called, If You Can Desire It, the Universe Can Produce It. It says, if your involvement in your time-space reality inspires within you any sincere desire, sincere, that's an interesting word in there, then the universe has the means to supply the results that you seek. Because your ability to reach for more expands with each achievement that came before, the expansion may feel breathtaking to those just coming to understand the power of it, but it may feel absolutely normal to those who have already come to understand and expect well-being to flow constantly into their experience. So basically, I guess what they're trying to say is when you're attracting this stuff because you have a sincere desire for it, some people may have a little trouble with the idea that that's why it's happening. And other people who are already familiar with the concepts that we're talking about here are going to say, yeah, that's just part of normal experience. So I guess they're kind of setting you up for don't worry too much about what other people think about it.
Yeah, and are you allowing yourself to be part of the stream of well-being or not?
Yeah, the stream of well-being.
That kind of, by saying that, that kind of brings that question up. It's like, oh, well, wait a minute. Am I allowing that? I hope so. Or kind of like, is that idea of trying to think about that?
And in fact, they go into more detail with the next sentence about it. It says, the stream of well-being flows even if you do not understand that it does. But when you consciously become aligned with it, your creative endeavors become so much more satisfying, for then you discover that there is absolutely nothing that you desire that you cannot achieve. Now, that's an interesting juxtaposition of concepts right there. They've been talking to us about this stream of well-being, about the role that we play in the expansion of the universe and the role that we play in contributing to not only the current but the future benefit of mankind and so forth. And then they tie in a twist here. The twist says, when you become consciously aligned, your creative endeavors become so much more satisfying. For then you discover that there is absolutely nothing that you desire that you cannot achieve. Now, I have to admit, I'm having a little trouble reconciling those concepts. I'm not saying that either one's wrong. I'm saying, why does one follow from the other? Do you have an idea on that?
Well, just that when you become aligned with what they're talking about and being at a high vibration, and when you're a vibrational match to what you want, then it can't help but manifest. Because they always talk about when you're a vibrational match to something, that it must manifest. So if you're kind of aware enough to know that, then I think that's kind of what they're talking about. Then you can't help but attract what you want.
But they're saying more. I'm looking at this one phrase in that sentence. Your creative endeavors become so much more satisfying.
Well, creative endeavors, meaning what does that mean?
Well, they've been using the word creative to mean what you think about, what you focus on. That is the creative process as they've described it. So your active focusing and attracting into your life the vibrational essence of what you've been focusing on, it becomes more satisfying, they say, when you consciously become aligned with the stream of well-being flowing in your life. In other words, the more that you understand the stream of well-being, the more satisfying it is. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just not so sure it's true.
But it does make sense if someone's allowing in the stream of well-being, and we can all tell if we are or not based on how we're feeling. If we're feeling really good and really high vibration, and we're allowing in the stream of well-being, then of course we're going to manifest what we want more than if we're not aware of that and not feeling that.
Yeah, we're going to manifest more, perhaps. It's the satisfying part. They're saying it's more satisfying if you're doing it consciously. And, I mean, that's an interesting concept. Is it more satisfying if I am consciously attracting than if I'm unconsciously attracting? I suppose in one sense it is.
I think so, because you're aware of why it's happening. Instead of it's just random, instead of something just randomly manifesting for you, when you're aware of it, then it's more satisfying because, like, oh wow, look, I've been keeping myself at a high vibration. I feel connected to the stream of well-being, and look, something, this wonderful thing manifested for me.
I think if they said something like, you are more satisfied by the understanding of one cause leading to another effect. You know, the cause being that you're focusing on something and thinking about something, and the effect being that it manifests. If they were saying that understanding that is a satisfying thing to understand, I think I could buy into that. That makes some sense to me. But they're also talking beyond that. They're talking about the creative endeavors themselves being more satisfying. Not the not just the concept of one leads to the other, but the actual activity becomes more satisfying. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I just, that's not something that I can say that I've experienced so far.
Well, we need to call Esther Hicks. We need her to channel Abraham, and we can read this little section so they can clarify it for us.
That, either that or else go to one of the workshops that they do around the country, one or the other.
Yeah, actually, I think there is one coming up in your area.
Yeah, I think there's one coming up in Boston, if I remember right. I can't remember exactly what the dates are.
Yeah,
but,
I think so.
Yeah, anybody who's curious, by the way, you can go to the Abraham Hicks website. It's easy, just Google it. It's really not hard to find. And they have schedules posted there about where Esther Hicks is and where the workshops are going on. And they happen all over the country and indeed in other countries around the world, too. So, you know, by all means, check it out.
But I did just get an email, and I know in October they are going to be on the East.
The East Coast.
I know there was something, I think, in the Philadelphia area, something in the Boston area. So definitely worthwhile going. I went to one a few years ago. It was very worthwhile to go.
Yeah, I remember you a couple weeks ago, you talked about that experience and how you got a lot out of it.
Yeah. I mean, when you see the videos online, it is similar to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, but just kind of being in the room is just very interesting.
How is it different?
Just because you're feeling the energy more, you're seeing it live, you're watching her channel Abraham live, and it's just kind of interesting and to be there for like a full day instead of like when you watch the little snippets on YouTube, they're like, you know, 15, 20 minutes. So it's interesting being there in the room, seeing it happen live.
Now, my impression, just from bits and pieces I've picked up looking on, you know, YouTube and so forth, is that Abraham has a tendency to pick and choose who they're going to call upon to talk to, and they seem to do it with an intention of I don't know, illustrating things, making points.
Well, what happens is, you know, a lot of people raise their hands when it's time to call someone else to the stage.
Yeah.
Or I think what they call the hot seat.
Yeah, right.
And, like, she'll pick someone, and she'll say something like, oh, okay, we were told to pick you.
Yeah.
Like, they always, like, it's not an accident who gets picked, apparently.
I heard her say one thing one time in the voice of Abraham that it doesn't matter what your question is, it's always the same answer.
That is kind of true. What are you focusing on? How are you focusing on it? And what can you do to improve it?
There's one particular recording that I heard that I thought had rather a kind of a cute, that you can tell if you do buy into the idea that this is a non-physical spirit from the other side, or actually a sort of a group of spirits from the other side working together and talking through Esther Hicks under the name Abraham. if you can accept that idea, I accept that idea. And I can kind of visualize how they're trying to reach out and present and in a sort of sense, entertain an audience, even mm-hmm. though they're non-physical. And you can mm-hmm. kind of imagine the challenges that are involved in that, because a lot of what entertainers do ties into, either in a large way or a small way, you know, pushing hot buttons and pain buttons, which you're mm-hmm. not going to have if you're not physical. So you can see, and you can actually hear it somewhat in the way that they phrase things and talk about things, because you can tell that they're
humor.
Trying.
There's definitely there's humor. Like she'll say, "Oh, you humans, yada yada." Like,
and sometimes
you humans love to do this and love to do that. So there's definitely humor interjected, which is important because it kind of lightens the mood.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And sometimes the humor really hits the mark, and sometimes the humor misses. That's the really interesting part.
But yeah, there's definitely a little sense of humor in some of the comments.
I'm trying to remember which presentation it was that I heard, but one of them began with, I guess they always start off pretty much the same way. We are glad to be doing this co-creative experience, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And in this particular case, she asked the audience, "Are you attracting what you're wanting?"
Yes, she does. Yes.
And you could kind of sense the audience, you know, some people reacting yes, no, whatever. And her response was, "Uh-huh."
Meaning what?
Like, yeah, okay, I sarcastically believe you, you know.
Oh, I see.
And so yeah, she says, well, let me ask the question another way. How many of you are currently, She says, how many of you are attracting what you want?
Mm-hmm.
And once again, she says, right. And then she says, well, don't worry, it's a trick question, because the answer is, if you are attracting what you want, you're living it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's really an interesting thing, because,
well,
first of all, there's an interesting problem with the word want. Want is a tough word. I don't know if you've ever noticed that.
Why?
Well, because on the one hand, we mean want to mean, like, you know, a 4-year-old wants something. I want that thing over there, right? But
right.
On the other hand, want also has a secondary meaning, which is to lack.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, I want, there's always a little piece of us that says, I lack.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why I prefer the word desire. Desire doesn't have lack necessarily associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
So when she says, you know what? Are you knowing what you are wanting? Which is kind of a weird way of saying things anyway. But are you knowing what you are wanting? She's utilizing a word that has a double meaning. And the thought that goes through my mind is, which meaning does she have in mind? Because it could be either one. But
yeah, I would think it's more of the, what do you desire?
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. But it just, if you listen into it with what the other meaning is, sometimes what they have to say is, it has a different message to it. It's really something,
mm-hmm.
and it makes me wonder if it's intentional. I think that's why I mentioned all this. It makes me wonder if they intentionally realize that they're using a word that has a double meaning.
I don't know. Again, we have to ask Esther to ask the source.
I mean, you can't rule it out if you actually do have, you know, a bunch of beings all contributing at the same time through this one voice. It's quite possible when you have that much mind power, so to speak, that they do understand and they're doing it deliberately. You know.
Now, what do you think about this? Because a lot of times Abraham will remind the audience that we don't want everything we want to happen all at once, because then it would just be too overwhelming. What do you think about that?
I have had a lot of problem with that concept. I mean, I wanted to know why it happened, first of all. And I think I understand now much better than I did why it happens. And the quick answer is resistance. But
what if you did get everything you wanted all at once?
Here's the thing. If we're going to assume that someone who is studying this stuff is doing it because they want to learn how to do it better,
mm-hmm.
which is a better way to learn quickly to, you know, shift your perspective in the way you want to shift it to? Is it better to have a long delay between when you try to attract something and when it shows up? Or is it better to have a short delay? You see what I'm saying?
I think most people would say a short delay.
I think it is better to have a short delay because it's you might get flattened by that elephant that you've been thinking about, but you're going to learn real quick to focus your thought. You're going to focus real fast because you're being inundated with all the stuff. You say, whoa, stop. And if you do understand that it's your thought that's doing it, you're going to stop. And if you don't understand, then you're in trouble. But if you do understand that it's your thought, okay, well, I'm attracting all this stuff. I now have a real big incentive to focus strictly on what it is that I want to attract into my life.
Yeah. But I also think that we never stop wanting. So in other words, like what somebody wants today, if it happened, if everything somebody wanted manifested for them, it wouldn't be too long before suddenly there'd be other things they want. And that's kind of interesting, too. Like, I don't think you ever stop finding things to want to attract or manifest.
Here's another question for you, too. If you focus on it, does it mean that you want it?
I hope so. That's why you're focusing on it.
Well, it may not. I mean, there are a lot of things that I find to be interesting, and so I'll focus on them momentarily because I find them to be interesting. But that doesn't mean I want more of them, necessarily. It just means I find that particular thing to be interesting.
Right. Well, that wouldn't be your dominant vibration, then. If it's just something you're just thinking about temporarily, then that would not be your dominant vibration about whatever it was.
So dominant vibration becomes the critical key element to this.
Yes.
That combined with the concept of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're really talking about here is dominant vibration and resistance levels.
Yes.
And indeed, that's kind of what they're talking about in the next section of the book here, of this particular chapter 7. It says, sometimes people will compliment Esther for being able to receive the wisdom of Abraham and for putting it into written or spoken word for others to experience and receive benefit from. And we also add our appreciation to that. But we also want to point out that Esther's receiving and translation of our vibration is only part of the equation. Without the asking that precedes it, there could be no answering. So, okay, here's people, you know, expressing their desires or their interests or whatever it might be. The people of your times are benefiting dramatically from the experiences of those generations that preceded you. Now, that's an interesting shift. We're talking about people who are receiving the information now, and all of a sudden we're shifting back to our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For through the experiences they lived and the desires that were generated within them, the summoning began. And today you are the ones on the leading edge of reaping the benefits of what those past generations asked for. At the same time, you are continuing to ask and you are now summoning, and so and on it goes. So can you see how if you can find a way to allow it, there is an avalanche of well-being at your fingertips, ripe for your plucking, providing you are in vibrational alignment with it? So they're really playing that theme. They're playing that theme of this isn't just you attracting stuff. This isn't just your dominant vibration being what comes into your life. They're talking about a much larger, wider perspective, the 10,000 foot view, so to speak.
Well, that's why it's important to be aware of what you're focusing on and how you're focusing on it.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I would think that when we're focusing on something, most of the time we're not thinking, well, you know, if I focus on this, this is going to have tremendous benefit for my children. Or for my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren. Can you imagine what this is going to do for my third great-grandnephew twice removed? No, that's not what we think about.
Well, but I mean, that's why people sometimes, too, have trouble with dealing with focusing on what you want over what is, because what is right. It's so easy to see and know.
So you think that's what they're doing here? They're trying to get people to distract them from what is and let them focus on something else?
Well, I think that's part of it, because as we know, we can't focus on what is and expect what we want to manifest.
If it's different.
Right, exactly. So that can be tricky, too.
Mm-hmm. It can be tricky. Interesting if that's what they're trying to do, though, if they're just trying to distract our attention. I mean, because I can think of different ways to, you know, distract our attention. That probably would not be high on my list, that particular method. So that's why I say, well, okay. I wonder what's making them decide to do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I wanted to distract somebody's attention from what is, the first thing I would want to know is what it is they want, and say to them, well, why not focus on that? I mean,
exactly, or
what's causing you to not focus on that? And they could, I'm sure, give me 1,000 reasons, you know, negative reasons about why, you know, it'll never happen and so forth. But at least now we're talking more directly. I guess what I'm saying here is that I get a feeling that the non-physical beings are much less connected to the day-by-day events than the physical beings are. And it shows up in their language. It shows up in their expression of ideas.
Yeah, I would say that's most likely true.
Yeah. So here's an example of how being a non-physical being, even if you're trying to entertain, it's a little bit of a challenge because the experience of physical versus non-physical are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
They're different experiences, and they don't, I mean, the idea of walking in another person's moccasins, well, it's really tough when you don't have moccasins. So anyway, let's continue on to the next section here. It says, open the floodgates and let your well-being flow in. And reading the first paragraph, see yourself right now where you are as the beneficiary of the powerful stream of well-being. Try to imagine that you are basking in the flow of this powerful stream. Make an effort to feel yourself as the leading edge beneficiary of this unlimited stream. And smile and try to accept that you are worthy of it. Now, do you actually do that? I have at times tried to feel a stream of well-being. And
right.
On good days, I certainly feel well-being. I guess I can kind of metaphorically call it a stream of well-being, but I don't really experience it as a stream. Do you?
Well, I actually wrote a guided meditation for my clients, and sometimes I use it on myself as well, to help them allow and feel the stream of well-being. And in the guided meditation, just so it makes it easier, I do have them imagine it is a stream, a shallow stream of well-being, and because I think it's easier to connect to. But of course, that's not a stream, really, like in that sense.
So getting back to my question, do you experience well-being as a stream?
Not a stream. It's more of a stream of energy, not a stream of like a shallow water stream.
So if I could be so bold, it would be like a continuous experience of it rather than water flowing by. It's more like
it's always there. It's always is.
Yeah.
It's just, am I consciously reminding myself that and that I can connect to it and that I'm already connected to it.
I mean, physically, I could describe it as being like, a spotlight comes on and you can hold your hand in the spotlight and you can always see the light on your hand. And if the light feels warm, you can always feel the warmth and it's continuous.
Mm-hmm.
If that's a stream, mm-hmm. then a stream of well-being is a good metaphor for what goes
on.
Yeah,
that works. Mm-hmm.
I just don't think of that as a stream. I just think of that as continuous. A continuity of well-being, that would make a lot of sense to me. Continuity of well-being, okay, now I can latch on to that. Stream of well-being doesn't really work. It's not like that I can feel, you know,
I guess I try to find a word that, I don't know, resonates with most people or something. I guess most people, like, get an image, a stream of well-being. They can dip their foot into it anytime they want or something. I don't know.
Perhaps what they're thinking is if you use the metaphor of a stream, maybe people will imagine a stream of cars and boats and all kinds of other desirable things floating past. You know, oh, good, there's mine. Okay, my ship has just come in. Maybe
that's
what it is.
I always like to remind myself that, though. Okay, wait a minute. Am I aware, can I make myself aware right now that I am consciously wanting to be connected or reminding myself that the stream of well-being is always there. It's always flowing. I can always connect to it or remind myself that I am always connecting to it.
Well, as I think I mentioned about two or three shows ago, for me, it took a long time to recognize that well-beingness, that feeling of well-beingness, because it doesn't have a contrast to it. That's what makes it a continuity of well-beingness. And because there's no contrast, we as humans, and I suspect as creatures of light and of energy, I believe it's both, we respond better to contrast. So when there is no contrast, we're almost blind to it. You know what I mean? It's almost like we don't even see that it's there. You have to really look to notice, oh, it's continuous over there, isn't it? Oh, it's continuous inside. I can feel that inside, and I've always felt that inside, and it doesn't go away. Oh, that's the stream of well-being. Oh, okay. You have it's a little harder to notice because without the contrast, it's hard to notice something. No matter what it is you're talking about. The contrast allows us to see, oh, yeah, there's the one hand, there's the other hand.
Yes, and this way feels much better to me than that way.
That's right. Yeah. That's another interesting thing. They've been talking about all this stuff, and they have not yet got into talking about feel and emotion. They haven't really gotten that far in this particular chapter. They're about to, though. They're
right.
About to get
they
to
must,
it.
They must, because that's a big part of it.
Right. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs down. It says, you and how you feel is all that is responsible for whether you let in your inheritance of well-being or not. And while those around you may influence you, more or less, to allow or not allow that stream, it is ultimately all up to you. Now, okay, now there's another phrase there. To allow or to not allow that stream.
Yes.
Now, I have a little bone to pick there. Again, this is a little time. This is almost like a sliver of a bone. It's barely a bone at all. But you know what? I don't think you can successfully not allow the stream. The most you can ever do is cover your eyes and not see it.
Well, I think what they mean in that is, like, say you go somewhere, you're feeling pretty good, and you go somewhere, and for whatever reason, someone's in a really negative mood, and they're really down, and you talk to them for a certain amount of time, and they're spewing all their reasons why they're not feeling good or they're feeling down, and then at that point, you could either let that affect you and bring you down and take you away from that stream of well-being, or you could walk out of wherever you were talking to that person and think, okay, wait a minute, just because they're at a low vibration, just because they're not feeling the stream of well-being right now, doesn't mean that I have to feel that way too. I can choose to stay this way, to stay in a positive way.
Well, yeah.
I don't have to let their low vibration bring me down. And that's a lot of times people do get brought down by other people.
Sure, yeah, and clearly that is a choice that we all have. Are we going to allow someone else to bring us down, as you say?
Yes.
But I think there's more to it than that.
That's one instance where you could allow or not allow the stream of well-being. You can block it or not block it for yourself.
I guess, yeah. I'm not so sure you can actually block it. I think the one phrase I heard that describes it pretty good from Abraham was that you can pinch yourself off from it, meaning that you can pinch off your experience of it.
Mm-hmm. Right, like in that moment, if, say, someone does let that other person bring them down, and then they're in a funk for the day because of that, then that's what they've done.
But I would also argue,
blocked it or pinched it off, or whatever the word
yeah.
is.
But I would also argue that even when you're pinching it off, it's not like you can actually disallow the stream. I think the well-beingness is always there, whether you're willing to recognize it or not. You can
right, whether
you
you're
can choose
to it. Yeah.
You can choose to try to ignore it and so forth, and pretend that it's not there and start feeling down and stay in that down state and just feel like there's no connection. But the connection's still there. It's not like it went away. It's just that you're choosing not to feel it.
Yes. It feels like it went away.
Yeah, I guess in that sense, it's sort of an experiential thing, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it did because you're in a funk.
Yeah.
He's like, wait a minute, where's the stream of well-being? So,
but I find
you can allow it in just as easily.
I find that it's easier to think of it in terms of it never going away, because then it seems a lot easier to me anyway to move from that negative realm to the positive realm, because all I have to do is recognize that it's there anyway. It never went away. It was never gone. I just have
right.
to, take my hands over my eyes and stop being the 2-year-old. Oh, yeah, it really is there,
Yeah. And sometimes that could be a quick experience, and sometimes it takes a little bit of time to allow it in again.
Well, it depends on how long I want to take to pull my hands from my eyes.
That's right.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
That's right.
And they finish off this section by summarizing this. This is where I think it all starts to come together. You can open the floodgates and let in your well-being, or you can choose thoughts that keep you pinched off from what is yours. From what is yours. In other words, it doesn't actually go away. But whether you allow it or resist it, the stream is constantly flowing to you, never ending, never tiring, always there for your reconsideration. So that that part, I think, actually reinforces what I'm saying.
You could always connect to it. It's up to you.
It's always there, and it never goes away. And that's important because if you get into a really bad funk, if you're in a really depressed state, you can begin to believe that you'll never get that connection back.
That's right.
And that this is a way of reminding anybody, even in the worst place, that you've never lost that connection. All you have to do is relearn how to notice it.
That's right. And unfortunately, most people don't know about this. So they are in a funk or depressed, and they don't know. That's what everybody could know.
Which, of course, is why they're wording it this way. So that, I mean, I get it. I understand what they're trying to do. So that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the next section is entitled, "You Are in the Perfect Position to Get There from Here."
Mm-hmm.
Nothing has to change in your environment or in the circumstances that surround you for you to begin to deliberately allow your own connection to the stream of well-being, reinforcing what we were just saying.
Yes.
You could be in prison. You could have been diagnosed with a terminal illness. You could be facing bankruptcy, or you could be in the middle of a divorce. And still, you are in the perfect place right now to begin. That's a big concept. Because that's what we were talking about before, how when you pinch yourself off, when you're in that really negative spot, you can convince yourself that you'll never find your way back. And what they're saying is, doesn't matter. No matter how badly you have allowed your life to go through, you know, focusing on the wrong stuff or whatever it might be, you're still in the perfect place to get back. And why are you in that perfect place? You're in that perfect place because the stream of well-being is always there. It never leaves.
So I always think, well, how come then a lot of people choose to stay in the funk or the upsetness or the drama? And I think it's just because, one, they don't know there's another option, and two, is just how a lot of people are raised and what we see on TV and how to, you know, we don't see people on TV bouncing back quickly, typically.
Well, a lot of it is habit. And habit is a subconscious thing, and it's a learned thing. So when we develop a certain habit, what we're really saying is we're developing a method or a mode of behavior that is comfortable and familiar. And because it's comfortable and familiar, we're loath to let go of it.
Right. Most people see other people staying in their funk and not knowing about the stream of well-being. So that's kind of how they think it is.
Oh, right.
That's how I have to be when something, quote, bad happens to me.
Sure. So that's the side that you were talking about where people just aren't aware of how this whole principle works.
That's right.
So there is that part
of it. Right.
But there's also the side that, you know, even for somebody who does understand how this works, they can still stay cut off. They can still stay depressed. And we could argue on the one hand that it's because they're refusing to focus consistently. Or we could also point out that people are creatures of habit. And so the habit is to keep focusing on the negative. It takes time to reverse a habit.
I also think, too, it depends what it is. Like some experiences, you know, it might take some time to get back, to start getting back into the stream of well-being and allowing it in. And then certain things you can do it quicker. I think that happens, too. Like it depends what it is.
Well, it depends on how deeply ingrained the habit is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a really deeply ingrained habit, even if you want to change, you can find it. It's like you're pushing against water or something. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't ever seem like you're making progress. And often what you have to do in those circumstances is just try to make little progresses wherever you can. And then over time, look back and notice, oh, wow, I've actually moved further than I realized.
Yes. Yes. And if, you know, something traumatic happens to someone, like, I don't know, maybe there was a death of a friend or a family member or whatever, then that probably would take longer to start getting back, allowing yourself to connect to that than other experiences.
Well, it depends on what your reaction is. I mean, if you react to it strongly and negatively, then that's going to be the case.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if the death of somebody or the loss of a friend or whatever is an event that you don't except in a traumatic way, it may be pretty easy to get around it.
Mm-hmm.
It may be easy to get past it.
It just depends on the circumstances and how and all that stuff. But
well, it depends on your reactions. It depends on how you respond.
Yeah, but I think certain things are easier to pull yourself up out of quicker than other things.
And I still think that's because of whether or not you find yourself willing to respond.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to, if you're only going to put in like a tepid attempt, I'll give it like one little quick attempt. It's going to be pretty tough. It's going to be tough going.
Yeah.
You know. But if you feel like, okay, despite this horrible event that has happened to me, I am just feeling really good about feeling positive, and I'm going to stay there. You get past it real fast.
Well, I think too, like if you know about what we're talking about, and you know about the law of attraction, you know about these things, then at a certain point, you kind of won't allow yourself to stay too long in a depressed way or a non-allowing way.
Certainly, if you focus on and practice the stuff over and over again, trying to get better and better at it, that is definitely going to be the case, yes.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. Now, they give us a vehicle example for the next paragraph. It says, when you drive your vehicle from place to place, notice they don't say car. There's another example. This is a non-physical entity trying to relate to a physical entity. So when you drive your vehicle from place to place, you have an awareness of your starting place as well as an awareness of where you are going. You accept that you cannot get there instantaneously. You accept that you will travel the distance, and in time you will arrive at your destination. And while you may feel anxious to get there and maybe even tire of the journey, you do not get so discouraged at the midway mark that you just turn around and go back to your starting place.
That's right.
You do not drive back and forth and back and forth from your starting point to the midway point and then finally collapse from the never-ending journey. And yet, how often do we do that in life with the tough problems, right?
Yeah.
It's a very common thing. They continue by saying, you do not announce your inability to accomplish your journey. You accept the distance between your starting place and where you desire to be, and you continue to move in the direction of your destination. You understand what is required, and you do it. And we want you to come to know that the journey between where you are and where you want to be on all subjects can be just as easily understood. That's a great aphorism. Now, here's the rub that they aren't addressing. The rub is, when you're driving from point A to point B, you know where point B is to some extent. You've seen it on a map. You know, you know it's west. You know, it's something like that. Very often when we're trying to get to a place in the more metaphysical law of attraction way, we really don't know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
So the metaphor starts to kind of fall apart a little bit because you certainly don't get on a highway saying, so where is it? Which way do I go? Do I go north? Do I go south? Do I go east? Do I go west?
But that's the thing, though, with law of attraction is that we can't get caught up in the how or the when. Because once you do, then it cuts you off from allowing the stream of well-being or allowing a high vibration.
Right, which is why the metaphor starts to fall apart. Because the metaphor implies when you get into a vehicle, when you get into a car, you have some idea where you're going and you have some idea where it is. And that's an important thing. I mean, the metaphor is useful because it does point to the fact that you don't want to just give up halfway through the journey because you'll never know where you're getting to until you complete the journey.
Yeah.
And that's valid. All I'm saying is it's a little bit of an oversimplification to say that it's really like trying to attract something because there are very different experiences. I mean, when I get into the car, I know what the experience is of going to New Jersey. I don't know what the experience is necessarily of trying to attract, I'm trying to think of an example. The wonderful girl of my dreams. Actually, I do know because I've done that. But you know, if I was a single person, that would be the thing I don't know, right? You know, it's a different experience, a different kind of thing, because I don't know the goal yet.
I like to use that metaphor as like when you're getting your car to drive to the market or wherever you're going, you have this like certainty that you're going to get there, and that's how I kind of like to explain. When there's something you want to manifest, that we all have to do our best to have that same kind of certainty. Like,
right. We
don't know when or how, but it's going to manifest. Like, there's that, like, with the market, like, we don't get halfway to the market and then turn around because we're not there yet. We keep going until we get there. That's how I like to explain that. And that with something you want to manifest, we have to have that same kind of certainty that it's going to manifest, like without any wobble, you know?
Yeah, it's certainty and it's single-minded focus. It's focus on one thing and one thing only and not allowing yourself to be distracted. It's a theme that I've seen in a number of sports movies. Greatest Game Ever Played is one example, or Legend of Bagger Vance, or Field
what
of Dreams.
In those?
Oh, for instance, in I've also read the book for the first one. Basically, it's a story of how golf landed in the United States, how it became popular.
Mm-hmm.
It first came, of course, golf was created gained popularity in Scotland and then in Great Britain, and for the longest time, it was Great Britain's game. And then it got imported to the U.S., and what happened was the one player from Great Britain who is the winningest player in terms of the British Open, the one who's won it the most often, most times, his name was Harry Vardon. And Harry Vardon, his nickname was the Stylist. He played in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and he was the golfer. He was the Tiger Woods of his generation. He was the Jack Nicklaus. Mm-hmm. Harry Vardon wrote a number of books, and one of the books he wrote got read by a young kid named Francis Ouimet, who lived just outside of the Brookhaven Country Club in Massachusetts, where the U.S. Open was played in 1913. And Harry Vardon and his friend Ted Ray were invited to play in the U.S. Open. They were like celebrities coming over here to visit and so forth. Now, 1913, U.S. golf really hadn't taken off yet. There was a U.S. Open. It had been going on for about 12, 15 years, something like that. But it hadn't really taken off yet. It was more like polo. It was the sport of the extreme wealthy. And in fact, there was a definite class system to it. There were the caddies and there were the golfers and there the twain shall meet, that kind of thing. Very similar to what was happening in Britain. In fact, it's also true that there was a big distinction between amateurs and pros. Pros were lower level. Amateurs were people who were wealthy enough who could just do this for fun. You know, so that was the higher level. Whereas the professional was the lowly professional. You know, because they took this wonderful sport of the rich, and they're doing it for money. You know,
how dare they?
In fact, even in Britain, it was impossible for Harry Vardon to go into the clubhouse. The clubhouse was for amateurs only; pros weren't allowed.
Yeah, wow!
Isn't that something?
A little different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, the story behind the movie is that the Vardon and Ray come to the United States. Now, Vardon had actually come to the U.S. about 10, 15 years before and done a tour. And in the course of doing that tour, he appeared in a sports, I think it was actually a sporting goods store in Boston. And a young Francis Ouimet saw him there and heard him and actually, I guess, became part of the presentation. He was showing people how he did his golf swing. Now, Harry Vardon, if you're not a golfer, this may not mean a whole lot to you, but Vardon invented a grip, which today is the dominant grip that all golfers use, called the Vardon grip. It's an overlapping grip. The grip that Francis Ouimet used was a more common one at the time, an interlocking grip, but you can visualize it in terms of your right pinky finger and your left forefinger interlocking, and then the rest of it being similar to what's known as the Vardon grip. But the point of all that is that Harry Vardon had this tremendous influence on the entire game, including on this young kid named Francis Ouimet. Well, in 1913, Ouimet was around 21 years old, something like that. And some of the organizers of the U.S. Open wanted to get a local amateur involved in the Open. So they invited him to try out and to see if he could get past the qualifying rounds to get into the Open. And he did. And what essentially happened in The Greatest Game Ever Played is that it tells the story of how Francis Ouimet, against all odds, won the U.S. Open. He was an amateur kid who beat these two best players from Great Britain. And he actually beat them soundly.
Wow.
It's a story that, actually, to this day, most people don't know about. But if it wasn't for Francis Ouimet, golf would not be popular. Because the effect that this kid had on beating these champions who came over from Britain was played up in the newspapers like you would not believe. And he became an instant national celebrity. He was as famous then as, say, Jack Nicklaus or Tiger Woods were today.
Right.
Instantly catapulted him into fame. And in the process, kids from all over the country started taking up the game of golf. One of the kids who picked up the game of golf at that point in time was a young kid named Bobby Jones, who became one of the greatest golfers of all time, and indeed is the only golfer in golf history who managed to win the Grand Slam, the four most difficult tournaments, all in the same year. No one's ever done that except for this guy.
Amazing.
There was another player who played in the same tournament named Walter Hagen. Walter Hagen was the playboy of of golf. In a sense, he was Tiger Woods.
Now, wait, so how does this relate to what they were talking about?
Okay, well, yeah, this is a long setup, but what they were talking about here is, let me reread this section.
Okay.
It says, let's see, where is it? I lost the point. We're at the end of this chapter. Where is it?
You'll find it.
Well, I'll just read the last paragraph and we'll see if I can tie it in. This isn't exactly what we're talking about, but it says, you did not announce your inability to accomplish your journey. You accept the distance between your starting point and where you desire to be, and you continue to move in the direction of your destination. You understand what is required and you do it. And we want you to come to know that the journey between where you are and where you want to be on all subjects can be just as easily understood. I guess I'm remembering now.
They didn't know that they were creating what they were creating, but they did.
Well, more in the context of what we were talking about. We were talking about the importance of focusing, and we were talking about the importance of being single-minded about it.
Yeah.
Well, Harry Vardon talked about that a lot, and he talked about it in the book that Francis We Met read, and Francis We Met used this to go on and win the U.S. Open. What he talked about was how you really want to, when you go to make a shot, you want to visualize the entire shot. You want to stand there at the shot, you know, stand there at the ball, and you've got the club in your hand, and you look out over the fairway, and you're trying to put the ball on that particular place, and you imagine how you have to hit it to get it there, and he describes how mentally you just pour yourself deeply into this until you become part of the shot. And in the process, you end up blocking out everything else.
Yes, and I think that's also part of feeling that certainty.
That's right.
By doing that, you can't help but feeling that certainty.
And the reason I mentioned the movie is, in the movie, they visualized this. They presented it in the movie in terms of Harry Vardon standing at his ball. And as he's standing there and he's looking out at the fairway, all the spectators start to go away. It's like they all start to disappear.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know, so they visually show you. I mean,
They kind of show you his thoughts. Yeah.
He starts scanning the gallery, and as he scans the gallery, everybody disappears.
And then
finally, there's like four guys left who are his four ghosts. When he was a young kid, there was a golf course, a major golf course built where he grew up. And these four men who were gentlemen were there to scope out the course. And of course, from the time he was a kid all the way up, he was haunted by these guys because they represent the people who won't let him into the clubhouse because he's a pro and because he's a caddy. And, you know, this isn't for your kind boy and all that kind of thing. So they're his ghosts of Christmas past, so to speak. They're the last ones that he's able to get rid of. And then they finally disappear. And now you have this panorama of an entire empty course with just him and the fairway and the flag. There's nothing else out there. It's a tremendous visual presentation of this whole idea of being single-minded and of blocking everything else out. That's what's so cool about the movie. The movie does lots of things like that to illustrate what it takes to really apply this stuff in a way that's going to work as consistently as you want and to eliminate that resistance that causes things to slow down.
And I think blocking everything out you don't want can also be achieved by focusing on what you want.
Right. Because
when you focus on what you want, it kind of does that.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Which is what Vardon wrote about. He wrote about how it's just you and the ball and the fairway.
Yes.
And that's all that there is. There's nothing else. It's just that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I used to play golf. I haven't played in many years. Just after watching that, I want to try it again. because I can say on those occasions where I play particularly well, where, you know, because of my height, I actually have an advantage that my height allows me to get extra distance and so forth. Ooh, we're getting a weird fluttering noise there. Hopefully that'll go away pretty quick. But I remember one time where, now, I've always used wood clubs. I've never had metal clubs. And, of course, metal clubs have been around for about 20 years. So you can tell how long it's been since I played golf. But I remember one time playing with my wood clubs, and I was on a tee, and they had marked the fairway out for a driving contest. So you could see how far, you know, 200 yards was, and 225, and 250, and 275.
Yeah.
And so, okay, well, here is an opportunity to find out, well, how far do I actually hit the ball, you know? And bear in mind, I'm playing with woods and not metal clubs, you know, so it's actual wood clubs, man. Right? So I get up there, and I got into that zone that he's talking about, that focus zone. I was really, really focused. I was focused so well that when I swung, I almost had trouble holding onto the club. My focus was so good. And I hit the ball perfectly. And the ball went about 290, which with a wooden club is amazing.
Wow.
It was a long hit. And it took a long time to come down. I mean, I'm just standing there, you know, admiring this. And unfortunately, I was playing alone. There was nobody within miles of me. So nobody saw me do this. I couldn't brag about it or anything, you know. But I was experiencing it. And I said, whoa. Holy cow. It just kept flying and flying. It was amazing how good that golf shot was. And it was purely because I allowed myself to really, really, really focus in a way that I normally didn't do. Now, the difference was at the time, I didn't realize it was the focus. I did that kind of by accident because I just was I wanted to get a good shot off. I just wonder what would happen if I would go back and apply that concept consistently shot after shot. It almost makes me want to take a golf
again. Or even out of things that you want to manifest, just to be that focused.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's what we're doing with a golf game. We're trying to manifest a low score.
Yeah, I mean, focus can definitely affect what you're attracting or not attracting, for sure.
It also is a reminder that we have the choice. We can focus weakly. We can focus strongly. We can focus somewhere in the middle. And it's all up to us.
Yeah, and sometimes people ask them, how often should I focus on what I want? And I always say, well, how much do you want to attract that?
Yeah, how much change do you really want?
That's right.
If you don't want any change, then don't focus very much.
That's right.
If you do want change, however, that's where you really want to focus. Mm-hmm. But it kind of reminds me, we did the series on The Secret, of course, and there was one particular segment of The Secret, it was in the video in particular, although it was also in the book, where there was the guy who was in his bedroom getting dressed, and the first shot you see of him is that he's actually naked standing in front of this mirror, but then you look at him in the mirror and he doesn't see himself as naked. He sees himself in this beautiful three-piece suit.
Yeah.
And I saw that the first time. I said, well, that's pretty weird. But what they were trying to illustrate was focus. They were trying to illustrate, doesn't matter what you're actually wearing. What matters is what do you visualize yourself wearing.
Well, did he get dressed?
They don't actually show you that. What they show you later on is that he was driving the car of his dreams, and he had gotten his big home and all this other stuff. So basically he had attracted all the things that he wanted to attract in his life. That's what they were showing out of it. But the way they did it was kind of weird.
And he was wearing a three-piece suit.
Yeah. Well, when he was out driving, I would hope so. Otherwise, the cops are going to pull him over. Well, David, as usual, we're using up our hour really quickly. We have just enough time for you to let people know how they can find you in case they want your help to learn how to focus and really be single-minded about it. How do they find you?
Yes, anybody who wants to try Law of Attraction coaching, they can just go to lifecoachdavid.com, and you can find out there how to contact me. I always offer a first free mini phone coaching session.
Which is a great thing to do. I also want to invite people who haven't already done so to subscribe to our podcast. Of course, if you listen to us on PRN, you can continue to do so. We'll be here hopefully for a long, long time to come. But we also encourage you to subscribe to the podcast directly at loatoday.net. You can just go there with your iPhone or your Android or whatever, and there's a little button there you can click to subscribe, and it'll automatically load it into your podcast software. And it is happening, David. We are getting more and more people to subscribe, so good stuff is happening. David, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yes, same here. Same. I look forward to next time.
We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.